Okay, I think we can get started. Thank you everyone for coming here, especially right after lunch. It was interesting when I saw that they put me in a ballroom holding 700 people. Haven't done that before, but this should be quite exciting. So before I dive right in, let me introduce myself and tell you a little bit about my background. My name is Tobias Klima. I've been with Microsoft for about 2.5 years. And those 2.5 years I've spent exclusively on the storage and file systems team, and part of that I spent working on spaces, storage spaces, which I will talk about today. So the idea really is today to talk about spaces and how you can get exceptional IOPS per dollar, the money you spend on these deployments. Let me give you a quick overview of what I want to cover today. I really want to make sure I level set so we're all on the same page on the basics of spaces first. Some of you may have heard about it already. Others maybe haven't heard about it at all but found the session title interesting. So I want to make sure we all get the same kind of understanding before going deeper. From there, I'll talk about the value proposition of spaces. Why did we develop it? Why did we design it? And why would it be interesting to you or your customers? What's really the key behind it that drives it? From there, I'll move on into some performance and efficiency aspects. When I mean efficiency here, I'm really talking about cost efficiency. Where does a cost efficiency come from, and what does it look like? And of course, what can we achieve with spaces? And then from there, closing out, I'll mention a little bit about deployment considerations, some of the things you might want to think about after the value prop and you see what we can do. And then, of course, we'll definitely have time for Q&A at the end. Given how many people we have here, what I suggest is hold your questions until the end. I will go through all my slides first, just do the presentation, and then at the end, feel free to come on up and ask questions here. I'll be here to answer questions. I have my colleague Brian here who will help answer questions as well, and we may have one or two other people helping as well. And of course, after this session, as well as throughout the week, you will probably be able find me and Brian or some of our colleagues at the storage booth at the data center and infrastructure management track down in the exhibition hall. So let's get going. The overall vision, where are we coming from with spaces? What we're really trying to do is enable storage in a cloud-first world. In order to do that, what we really need to achieve is to dramatically lower the costs and effort that come with actually delivering storage to you, or to your customers for that matter. The interesting piece about cloud is that it is massive scale. So as soon as you have anything, be it performance, be it cost, be it capacity, that does not scale well, you will hit those issues very, very quickly in any kind of cloud deployment or any kind of scale deployment. So you really need to achieve linear scaling. How do we go about doing that? Storage spaces is built on the idea of deploying industry standard commodity hardware. This is one of the big reasons why we get very cost efficient. You can deploy simple SAS JBODs. You can deploy industry standard servers that you can get from different OEMs. So the example here in this diagram that I'm building up is, this is a storage piece. You have shared SAS JBODs at the bottom that contain your disks. On top of this, you layer regular servers that you can turn into scale-out file servers inside a cluster, and this is really the hardware you're running on. This is the core. On top of this, you can then layer your workloads. You use SMB, low overhead, really fast networking protocol, to get the throughput that spaces can deliver directly to your workloads. So in this case, a Hyper-V cluster. And the management that you use to stitch all of this together is ideally through PowerShell or SCVMM as well. The key about this diagram here is that I really want to drive home is that what we're doing is we're disaggregating compute and storage. You can scale the two pieces individually. So if you have a workload and a deployment that demands a lot of storage, but you have more than enough compute nodes, you can actually only scale the storage piece. You can decide, okay, I don't have a fully filled out file server cluster yet. I'm going to add another JBOD, and there's your storage piece, but you don't have to increase the compute. Alternatively, if you have more than enough storage in terms of performance and capacity, you can add more servers to your Hyper-V cluster and that way deploy more VMs. Storage spaces, the basics. What is it? In its simplest form, is software-defined storage. What we did was we looked at traditionally existing storage solutions and figured a lot of these capabilities could simply be provided by the OS itself. So we pulled a lot of this into the OS, which now comes with Windows Server 2012 R2. It's directly in there. And this is what it looks like. In this case, we have two JBODs. They are 24 bays each, and we want to stand up a Spaces deployment on them. We grab the disks that are in this JBOD and simply aggregate them into a pool. The pool is a unit of isolation and management. This is not what you would today consider a LUN or a virtual disk yet. This really just encompasses all the disks that we have here and we want to use. Out of the storage pool, we then create the storage spaces. And these spaces can have different characteristics. They can have different resiliency types. They can have different performance aspects, as well as capacity points and utilization points. And these storage spaces, this is what would map to what a LUN or a virtual disk is. So this is what will be exposed. The storage space is what will be exposed to the operating system. Storage spaces was introduced in Windows Server 2012. So now with the R2 release, we've had a little practice. We've been working on it. We continue to work on it. And we've been at it for a little while. And then, as I will show in this presentation, and I'll go deeper into, what we really provide here is cost reduction and cost efficiency, as well as scalability and performance. So another note on the hardware that we allow you to deploy here. We really enable you, as I said, to deploy industry standard hardware that doesn't necessarily carry very high premiums. The SAS JBODs that we build spaces on don't have any smarts in them. They're really just there to house disks and expose those disks to the hosts on top. Dual-ported SAS drives, all available from different vendors in the industry, can be sourced and put into these SAS JBODs. The main reason we're using SAS here is that the bandwidth that the protocol gives us is so significant. We get 24 gigabits per second out of a single SAS cable, and this is 6 gig SAS. Once the industry moves to 12 gig SAS, of which some examples you can actually see on the exhibition floor already, we'll have 48 gigabits per second per cable. So the fabric itself that we use to stitch together the storage is definitely not going to be a bottleneck for us. And then the third piece, SAS HBAs. In storage spaces deployments, you do not have to pay the premium that RAID devices oftentimes command, because these capabilities come in the OS directly, in Windows Server 2012 R2 and 2012, and we provide it right there for you. There's an extra cost beside the server license, which you probably have anyway, or your customers do. Capabilities. If you're familiar with traditional storage, you'll find that a lot of this shows up there as well. So we have different resiliency schemes that you can take advantage of. They're mirror and parity spaces. So in one case, we store multiple copies of data, two copies or three copies, depending on what type of resiliency you need, as well as parity, from which we can reconstruct missing data. We have native data striping for all spaces. This is really what drives performance. The idea being that a single I/O, be it a read or a write, can be serviced by multiple disks in the underlying storage infrastructure at the same time, and thus you get lower latencies and higher throughput. Third piece, enclosure awareness. This is one I'd like to call out in particular because I think it's very valuable and quite cool. When you have multiple SAS enclosures, SAS JBODs that you're deploying, you can define at creation time of the storage space that it be enclosure aware. What this means is, take for example, you deploy a mirror space which has multiple copies. Enclosure awareness will ensure that two copies of the same data will never reside on the same enclosure. So you'll have copy one on enclosure A and copy two on enclosure B or C, which means at this point, we're not only resilient to disk failure, but we're also resilient to enclosure failure. And then lastly, storage tiering. This is something we introduced in the R2 release, Windows Server 2012 R2, and I'm sure you're familiar with, and the basic ideas behind it being that we move data that is very frequently accessed on fast storage, usually SSDs, and the large data sets that exist in your storage deployment that, however, are not constantly accessed, we house on slower storage. A word on integration. So Storage Spaces is fully integrated with Windows clustering. You can cluster storage pools, you can cluster storage spaces, and tie them in with the CSV, the cluster shared volume, which I'll mention again later on. And this really provides you the ability to build a continuously available storage subsystem for your workloads. We support scale-out file servers in SMB. Again, this is a significant piece for performance that you can derive out of your storage. We can have all the throughput from SaaS that we want. If we don't have that connection piece, the SMB piece, to your workloads, that doesn't help us. We need to be able to scale that performance up and deliver it to your workloads. And then lastly, the end-to-end management that we really recommend is PowerShell. Anything that you can do in terms of management or deployment for spaces can be done through PowerShell. And once you understand how PowerShell works properly, you can do amazing things. You can stand up entire deployments in no time at all. In fact, to that point, an example is we had a customer come to us, work with us in one of our engineering centers, and they wanted to look into a problem they had seen with spaces. We had enough hardware on hand, but we didn't know exactly what topology they were deploying. What pools did they create? On which storage? With what storage spaces and resiliency schemes? That customer actually came in with a set of PowerShell scripts that allowed them to essentially replicate their deployment in our engineering center in a matter of half an hour or an hour, and we could then directly dive in and start debugging whatever issues they had. Innovation. This is a piece that not a lot of people can offer, I believe, and we have something really cool here. We can actually use storage spaces almost as a channel for you to partake in the innovations we drive into our data centers. An example of this is a local reconstruction code algorithm, which specifically is used to improve significantly the rebuild times of parity type spaces. This was originally pioneered by Microsoft Research, was then picked up by Windows Azure Storage, and is today used in Azure data centers. And this is what we included in the parity schemes that are available to you with storage spaces in Windows Server 2012 R2. And we're by no means stopping here, so other innovations we find, we will be putting into spaces as well in the future. Value proposition, the why. Why did we do this and why is it interesting to you? This is really one of the main pieces I want to drive home today. Cost. Cost, cost, cost. This is the primary reason we did this. The cost of storage is a problem. In fact, especially with traditional storage, cost on IT budgets can be a major, major item. Oftentimes, cost is driven up by so-called value-add software. This is something we're trying to address with spaces. If you think about IT budget, storage can take up anywhere between 5 and 10% to 50% of that entire budget. And we thought, there's got to be a better way to do this. So our goal was to provide a cost-effective alternative to existing storage solutions that are out in the market. Our solution to that, of course, was storage spaces in Windows Server. And some of the results we've seen were actually quite amazing. So we worked with a customer. There's a specific case study, which I linked to here, which you can look at later, to switch them over to storage spaces from their previous deployment. They were able to reduce their spend on storage by 30%. What that fundamentally looked like in their budget was, before storage spaces, they had allocated 40% of their budget to storage. Afterwards, that number was only 25%. That means either the savings can go directly to their bottom line, or they can use those extra 15% to spend on other IT-related items. Here's another case study that I would like to cover. This is an internal one we did with our Windows release team, or sometimes called build team. These guys are directly responsible for, quite literally, building Windows. So the product teams and the servicing teams, they make bug fixes, they write code, etc. But that code has to be compiled and packaged into what you would know as a Windows build that comes either on media or you download from MSDN. That is what the build team does. These guys handle massive amounts of data every week, hundreds of petabytes, that flow through their pipeline. They had problems to deal with in terms of capacity, cost, and resiliency. They needed to be able to keep around data build data for about a month so that we, the product teams, were able to actually go back to fix bugs up to 4 weeks. It was not very convenient to say, oh, wait, this bug happened, let's look at it, but hey, we don't have that build around from 2 weeks anymore. So this directly helps us. They needed to dramatically lower the cost or the amount of money they spent per terabyte deployed because they didn't have a platform that would scale very well. And that's the third point as well. They needed a platform for future expansion. What they had deployed pre-Spaces was a model where they would have individual servers that had direct attached storage. So they would just put drives into those servers, and every time they needed to extend their storage, they would have to buy a new server. This is the exact opposite of what I was talking about beforehand of disaggregated compute and storage. Given their workload, this is a workload that's very, very storage intensive, needs a lot of capacity. They had way more compute resources than they needed. In fact, they had about 120 servers deployed. So switching them over to Spaces was almost a revelation for them. They were able to achieve double the throughput they had before. Remember, servers with 4 or 8 drives in them versus SAS enclosures with 60 drives in them that can then use that SAS fabric to push all their throughput to just a few server nodes. That's where the throughput came from. In fact, when they originally deployed Spaces, they found very quickly that they, in the same building, had to upgrade the network infrastructure because we brought down the network. They saw as well a threefold increase in raw capacity. The threefold increase is interesting because it's directly tied to their budget. So at the beginning of the fiscal year, they were allotted enough budget to replace a third of their original infrastructure, just a third. Taking that budget, they came to us and started talking to us about storage deployments and storage spaces. With that third going to Spaces, they were able to throw out their entire old infrastructure. That's why they had a threefold increase in raw capacity. Their workload works very well with deduplication, so they layered that on top of as well, which works just fine with Spaces. The effective capacity increase they achieved by this was fivefold compared to what they had before. And then lastly, number of servers reduced by 6x. Remember, instead of having a single server with 4 drives or 8 drives in them, they now had scale-out file servers with storage spaces and SAS enclosures at the bottom, which meant was they went from 122 servers that all had their individual storage to just over 20 servers that were hooked up to massive 60-bay JBODs. If you think about this, that is how many, it's about 100 servers less at 1 or 2. That's 2.5 racks that you save right there. And then they had a 66% reduction in the cost per terabyte spent, and that ties back directly into the budget that was approved with the third of the original, et cetera. I have a case study link here as well if you'd like to look at it when you download the slides later. There are more numbers in there that might be interesting to you. And luckily we had Jeremy Russell, who was one of the main folks that we worked with, give us a quote which read, "We're able to use commodity hardware to achieve the same functionality of traditional storage at a far lower cost." And that's really what we set out to do. So sticking with large capacities and scale, data deduplication worked really well for the Windows build team. Dedup works in conjunction with Spaces. So this is where you can really drive down the cost per terabyte that's deployed. It's very, very useful for specific workloads. It's amazing for VHD libraries because there are a lot of duplicates that you can actually combine. It also works very well for software deployment shares, just like in the Windows release team study. But not only can you drive down the cost per terabyte, Dedup can also provide you some performance benefits. That chunk store that aggregates the duplicates can actually be compressed and put in RAM. So think about this scenario. You have your VHD library nicely compressed and stored in the chunk store. The first VM you boot, fine, you have to go to the storage, and whatever IOPS the storage can serve you, that determines the VM boot time. However, the second, third, fourth, 10th, 100th VM, given that the chunk store can now live in RAM, means you're essentially booting these VMs out of RAM, and you can get significant performance gains this way. Here's a pretty cool graph that we actually got from the Dedup team, which gives you approximate savings that you could expect that we were able to see in different workload styles. And as I said, this really helps drive down further the cost per terabyte spent. If you'd like to learn more, there's a talk tomorrow listed here, which goes directly into Spaces dedupe in a VHD environment. Okay, one more slide on capacity and data at scale. Something that you have to consider, even though you have resilient deployments, is those deployments need to be available. Those file systems need to be available. And in the past, check disk for this has been a problem. I've seen a couple of frowning faces, and I know why. However, I can at least say that check disk isn't a problem anymore. Check disk was changed, and specifically its health model was changed, not in R2, but even in Windows Server 2012. The fact that made check disk terrible was that the scan that had to happen to identify the corruptions in a volume took by far the longest time. What we changed was that we asked ourselves, why does a scan has to happen when the file system's offline? We're just reading files. We're not manipulating them. We're not changing them. So the change that was fundamentally made was that that scan now happens online. Your file system is up. Your applications are running. You still get all the I/O performance, and we're just doing a scan in the background to figure out where are the corruptions. We keep a log of the corruptions we find, and we only need to take the file system offline to fix these corruptions, which usually doesn't take more than a couple seconds because we know exactly what they are and where they are. In fact, here's a study we did with in comparison between Windows Server 2012 and 2008 R2. We created volumes with 100, 200, and 300 million files, so a lot of files, and introduced a single corruption into them that we knew NTFS could not fix by itself. The offline times you see here, in the 300 million files case, we take the volume offline for over 6 hours, which frankly isn't acceptable. With the new health model, because we now scale with the number of corruptions, not the number of files on the volume, we actually would only take the volume offline for seconds at a time. In fact, that gets better when you're integrating this with clusters. If you have clustered file servers, for example, and you're deploying a clustered shared volume, that clustered shared volume sees all I/O that goes through the cluster down to the storage, all of it. So what this allows us to do is, if we find a corruption and we pinpoint it, we can pause I/O at the CSV layer for a few seconds, have check disk get in there, fix the corruption, bring the volume back, and I/O continues. There is no service interruption for your applications. No failing I/Os, no I/Os at timeout. They're simply paused for a few seconds, corruption is fixed, and you're back up and running. So at this point, let me switch gears, going from pure capacity-optimized deployments to performance. And for this, we have a demo prepared. And the point here really is to show what can storage spaces give you? What can it achieve in terms of performance? What we're running here is two workloads. The first one is 4 kilobyte random reads. And we're deploying 24 SSDs that are spread across 2 JBODs. I'll show you a picture of the actual deployment in a second. And we're running this from 4 cluster nodes across a 4-node cluster. Let's have a look. The top counter gives you the number of IOPS we're achieving. This is really how many IOs can we process. Oh, let's try that again. And it looks like the demo is broken. Of course it is. Why not? Good thing we have backup videos. I can still show you what's happening. Let's have a look at this. Again, first workload is random reads off of a spaces volume across that cluster. We're clocking in at just under 1.5 million IOPS. And the lower one that you're seeing is giving you throughput, megabytes per second. The throughput we're achieving with this 4K random read workload is over 5 gigabytes a second. Again, the cool thing is that we have that SAS infrastructure, which really allows us to drive whatever performance the drives underneath can give us. We can take advantage of all of that. Here we have the 4K reads. You probably can't read that without binoculars. But the aggregation really is 5.5 gigabytes a second of throughput and 1.41 million IOPS. Now we're switching over to a different workload. We thought about doing a sequential read off of those same SSDs we're deploying, but we figured if you actually have a virtualized environment, that makes no sense. As soon as you virtualize your environment, what actually gets to the storage underneath, even if you have sequential workloads on top, ends up looking like it's a random workload. It might have larger chunks, but it's still going to show up random. So what we did, we changed the scale on the IOPS here. The max now is, I think, 50,000, and we're only hitting just over 40,000 IOPS. But take a look at the throughput. We're running with significantly larger blocks. We're still doing random reads, but the block size is now 256K. And the throughput we're hitting, even though we only have 40,000 IOPS, is over 10 gigs a second. Again, through that SAS fabric that gives us 24 gigabits per cable deployed. Excellent. Let's go back to the slides. Here's what we actually deployed. This is the hardware we have in our lab in Redmond. We're deploying four server nodes that we cluster together. Those are connected directly to two 60-bay JBODs. The 60-bay JBODs are populated with the following. We have 12 SSDs in each of varying capacities because that's the only thing we could get our hands on 2 weeks ago. And we have a little over 90 hard drives that are in there as well for a tiered deployment that I'll get into later on. And all of this, again, stitched together with SAS. We have 16 SAS cables here, such that we have redundant paths from each server node directly to each JBOD. So each server node has at least two paths to every single disk in this deployment. And the overall throughput we get is something we would never achieve anyway with the storage we have here. That was a performance piece. So I've talked a little bit about capacity and what kinds of capacity point storage spaces can handle, as well as performance. But most workloads don't fit into one extreme or the other extreme. Most workloads, in fact, are somewhere in the middle. They need to be able to hit capacity points, but at the same time provide a certain IOPS number for peak workloads or peak times. So let's say your storage architect told you, OK, we need to have 16 terabytes of capacity and 180,000 IOPS, because this is when everybody is starting their machines or doing online transactions. It's basically cost prohibitive to deploy this with either only hard drives or only SSDs. I don't even know how many hard drives you would have to buy to get to 180,000 IOPS. It's a lot. And SSDs would be too expensive to just hit the capacity goal. So really what you want to be able to do is balance this. You want to be able to use the hard drives to get to the capacity point, and then buy only as much in terms of flash capacity that you need to hit that IOPS goal. There's the table here basically makes a comparison between a pure SSD deployment to hit this and a combined deployment, and the numbers speak for themselves. This is where tiering comes in. Again, the idea being we want to move the often used data directly into the fast tier and the not often or not often accessed data to the slower tier, the hard drive tier. This is really a game of matching workloads. So the overall data set you have, the big blue circle here, oftentimes is not accessed very often. That working set, that blue circle, is really what you want to match. In fact, the interesting thing about a working set is that it can change over time. Very few workloads, I believe, have a working set that is exactly the same at all times. As your workload evolves and changes, that working set will evolve and change as well. So you need a capability to follow this change and adapt for it. And this is what we did with the tiering that we have in 2012 R2, where we'll automatically detect what your working set is, promote that into the SSD tier, and promote the data that's not often accessed, or sorry, demote the data that's not often accessed into the slower tier. Before moving into the performance part, one specific capability I'd like to call out here at this point is the notion of admin override for tiering. Since the storage space's tiering engine integrates directly with the file system we have, we're able to give you the ability to pin files or folders directly to a given tier. Take the following scenario. You just set up a VHD library for a training class that comes in next week. you know that these guys will be booting and crashing and rebooting these VMs constantly, over and over and over. So instead of waiting for the tiering engine to promote all that stuff up into the SSD tier, you can go in and pin that entire folder with your VHD library directly to the SSDs. At that point, the VM boots will basically happen directly out of Flash. And the VHD library will stay in there until you decide you don't want it there anymore. So tiering will not start moving things around on you. The way to do that really is PowerShell, and the commandlets that you'd use for this are directly given here. OK. At this point, I want to look a little bit more at performance, and from there go into the efficiency piece I was talking about. Let me stick with tiering for a moment. Here's a diagram of what this might look like. Again, bottom, the blue, the cold data, this is where you have your hard drives, your SAS hard drives, 7,200 RPM, 4 terabytes, 5 terabytes, really good and efficient in terms of cost per gigabyte. The red tier, the SSDs, very efficient in terms of dollar you spend per IOPS you get, but this is where you want to have your working set. I mentioned integration with the file system. What this lets us do is the file system, in fact, is the piece that measures heat on the files that are on your deployment. It contains our heat engine. We have efficient tracking of the heat. That means we don't just grab an entire file and put it in the SSD tier, because you may have massive files and only small portions of these files are actually frequently accessed. It makes no sense to put the entire file into SSD. We'll only grab the portions of the files that we know are often accessed. That helps us be very efficient about how much of the SSD capacity we use. File deletion is another interesting point. If you delete files out of the SSD tier, since we have that file system integration, we can directly map trim commands down to the physical layer and free up that flash capacity. We don't have to wait for the tiering engine to come along and realize, oh, this file hasn't been accessed in so and so long. Let me demote it, and then realizing it was deleted. I don't need it in any tier anymore. We can do that immediately and give you that capacity in your SSDs back. Another one is heat follows file data. What this means is if you copy files in your storage deployment, we can actually keep track of the fact that these files were in a given tier. Just because the physical location of this data changes, since we integrate with the file system, means we don't lose track of whether or not this data is hot or cold. And then lastly, of course, as I've mentioned, the admin-controlled pinning you can do. And we have a couple of customers that actually actively use this. Data movement. Data movement in storage spaces tiering happens based on a scheduled task. This scheduled task is actually something you can directly modify and configure. So if you don't like that it only runs once a day, you can increase the frequency of how we move and when we move data. Tiering is a good way to increase the overall performance of your workloads, of your steady workloads that run on your storage deployments. But the interesting thing is that we get an extra capability with the flash capacity and the flash tier we have here. In fact, we also have a write-back cache in storage spaces, in tiered storage spaces. So we use the same capacity from these SSDs to create a write-back cache. These two technologies really complement each other. The tiering gives you increased performance for your steady workloads, and the write-back cache, in a way, protects them. So when you have heavy writes coming in, spikes that are just temporary, those can be absorbed by the write-back cache and not interrupt the long-running workloads you have now in steady state. Monitoring and analysis is also important. How do I know that the tiering works? How do I know I actually get the performance? Of course, you can look at performance counters. We have performance counters for virtual disks. We have them for physical disks. And you can directly check, am I actually getting the IOPS that I'm trying to get out of these, out of this tier? Secondly, tiering report. And this is a very, very good one. You can modify the scheduled tiering task to actually dump out a tiering report every time it runs. This report helps you answer questions such as, how big is my working set? Without that kind of information, it's difficult to make decisions on sizing. How many SSDs should I deploy? It can also give you ideas as to how many IOs that are part of the working set are actually hitting my SSD tier, or should I deploy more or less flash capacity? So you can make sizing decisions based on this. So let's go to the second demo. Let's see if this works. This is a tiering demo we put together. The idea is that we have four files that are sitting on storage spaces, tiered storage spaces, but those files are currently pinned exclusively to the hard drives. So again, we had somewhere around 90 hard drives in those two JBODs. And on those hard drives, we now have the four files that we are going to move. Here we go. The steady state IOPS we get out of these hard drives is about, do we have here, 16,000 or so? 16,000 is a lot for hard drives, but there's a specific reason for this. Since we only have about 2 gigabytes of data here and the hard drives are otherwise empty, we're short-stroking these things like crazy. We're only running on the outer tracks because there is no further data. That's why we get 16,000 IOPS out of hard drives. Once you have full hard drives, the number will actually be a little lower. If you look at the last counter, the one on the left, you can see what our current IOPS is. Again, we're doing a random read workload here, and we're currently in the process of moving those four files from the hard drives to the SSD tier. So we started at 16,000. We're now at about, 220,000, 230? The first file is moved. Now we move on to the second file, and we just keep on going. 400,000 IOPS. It looks like the network isn't holding up so well. Over 500,000, the third file is moved, and we got one more to go. And as you see, the more we move, the more extensive the files we move, the more we hit into flash, and now we top out at a steady state of about 660,000 IOPS. And we move these four files in, 55 seconds. Good, I'm glad this demo actually worked. Tiering. Now, this slide is probably one of the most interesting slides in the deck. So if you didn't listen, that's fine. This is probably the most interesting slide you'll get out of this, because I'm costing out the demo hardware we used here. Before I get to the overall cost number, some of the metrics we have. About 7 terabytes of flash we have deployed here, the 24 SSDs. 320 terabytes of rotating capacity. Note that we actually are missing some hard drives here, so we could have more rotating capacity, and some of them are 3, some are 4 terabytes. Performance we've seen from the first demo, over 10 gigs of throughput and about 1.4 million IOPS. And then footprint, this is one I'm particularly proud of. We're squishing all of this into just 16U. Again, 2 big enclosures and 4 servers. Here's the cost. The two JBODs come in at about 20 grand, and this is based on MSRP. SSDs and HDDs make up for a bulk of the cost here. Then, of course, we have cables, et cetera, and a big chunk for the servers. What I should note is that the servers here are actually more expensive than they would have to be. Again, this is a fragment of the fact that we had to get whatever hardware we could get our hands on at the time. These servers have almost 400 gigabytes of RAM. You definitely don't need much RAM for your storage nodes, so the cost on the servers can come down. And if you do the math on this, these are some of the points you come out with. So the cost per terabyte here for the raw capacity that we get out of this deployment is just over $500. The IOPS we get is a little over 8, and then the efficiency, again, really cool. The terabytes we squish into a single U of rack space is 20. And if you actually don't deploy a mix of 3 and 4 terabytes, but only 4 terabyte drives, maybe even larger ones, you can push that number up even higher. Okay, before moving on to the deployment considerations part, I want to quickly talk about rebuild and rebuild times. This is something that is also related to performance, but a lot of people don't always think about. When you design for the cloud, what you have to be aware of is that you need to design for failure. You can't just assume that everything will always work and run just fine. When you have hundreds or thousands of servers running workloads, you will have drive failures. There is no way around it. It will definitely happen, and you have to be resilient to that, which means you have to recover data and rebuild it. In 2012 R2, we actually changed how Storage Spaces performs its rebuild. We parallelized it, and we basically alleviated the need for hot spares. At this point, all drives in a storage space, in a mirror space, partake in the rebuild operation. The experiment we made was that we had a four-column two-way mirror space that consisted of 8 drives, and those drives were 3 terabyte in capacity. We failed one of them and forced a rebuild, so we actually had to rebuild 2.4 terabytes. That rebuild operation took 49 minutes, which gives you a throughput number that you can calculate of over 800 megs a second. And that's really the idea here, to speed up the rebuilds that can happen with storage spaces. Okay, so quick recap. Improved mean time to recovery, that's a quick rebuild piece that mirror spaces can do. Large capacity is no problem. It's a case study of the Windows release team. And with CSV and clustering, you can make those deployments highly available. Linear scaling, we can give you millions of IOPS, not a problem for us, and whatever throughput you can get from the storage devices, because the SaaS fabric doesn't get in the way. And then, of course, we have different resiliency types, end-to-end management, et cetera. So now a word on deployment considerations. What else do you have to think about when you want to deploy these things? First of all, how big can I go? How do I scale this thing? Here's the idea. You can deploy 4 JBODs with 4 servers, and those would make up a storage unit, a scale-out file server cluster. Why 4? 4 because it depends directly on how many physical ports you have on the back of the JBODs and the servers, meaning how many SAS cables can I actually hook up? We have 4 in this case because we need to be able to run 2 SAS cables from each JBOD to each server, meaning in this case it's 8. On these JBODs, on the ones we used back in Redmond, we had 4 ports per I/O module on each JBOD, so we could actually, if we'd had more hardware, we could have scaled out to this degree. This means you can deploy 240 drives in this single file server cluster, 60 per JBOD. I'm just seeing there's actually a typo here. This should say 768 gigabits per second instead of 786, 32 times 24. I'll make sure that's fixed in the slides when they get uploaded. So this is what provides you storage. This is your storage chart at the end. Come on up at the end, and we can ask your questions. These file servers get clustered. At that point, you create clustered storage spaces and clustered pools, which you then fill out. And on top of this, you layer the cluster shared volume, which really provides that unified namespace. That means you can access any storage space from any cluster node, regardless of where you access it. And this, through SMB, is then shared out to your workloads on top, preferably running Hyper-V. So that's how far you can go. Really, it depends on how much resiliency do you need and how many SAS cables can you hook up. Storage spaces, as I mentioned, is a part of Windows Server. It comes directly with the server license. You do not have to pay the premium of RAID. In terms of spaces and its maturity, we're actually putting our money where our mouth is because the Windows build process relies on it. If it didn't work properly, we couldn't do our jobs back in Redmond. The case studies that you can look at show we've had successful customer deployments, and the customers we have deployed with have been super happy with the cost savings they were able to achieve. And we have an ecosystem for this. So another question you'll probably want to think about is, where can I get the hardware from? First place to go is probably the Windows Server catalog. There's a bunch of certified storage spaces hardware already in there. The vendors are listed. Some are even here on the expo floor. In fact, Dell just recently made an announcement for a 60-bay JBOD, which you can see on the expo floor as well. We have several OEM partners, and all of this boils down into the simple fact that you have flexibility and choice. You can decide what you want to deploy and what quantity from which vendor. So innovation, again, I would like to reiterate that we actually try to give you innovations that we ourselves have in our data centers. We try to drive those through storage spaces and to you such that you can partake in these innovations as well. And the goal we're following really is we continue to push for cost reduction in storage and providing an alternative here. few more notes: deployment, management, and troubleshooting. You'll want to be able to do setup and a deployment quite easily. We have UIs that can help you with this. So you can actually do deployment through SCVMM, for example. You can use events that notify you of a failing disk so that you know which disks to replace and when to replace them. PowerShell and SCVMM give you the end-to-end management capabilities you need. Through perf counters, as well as the tiering report, you can perform analysis. How much performance am I getting out of this? How much flash storage do I have? Do I need more? Sizing ideas. And then, of course, we have clustering for continuous availability, as well as SMB and scale-out file servers for scale and performance. If you'd like to know more about this, specifically sizing and troubleshooting, you should absolutely go to Brian's session, which is listed here. Unfortunately, it's Wednesday morning, so you have to get up early. But it's a very, very, very good session to attend if this was an interesting teaser to you and you'd like to know more. So at this point, let me quickly sum up. And at that point, we'll have quite a bit of time for Q&A, I believe. I started with a brief intro to storage spaces and software-defined storage. I hope I was able to kind of get us all on the same page here. Moving on to value proposition, outlining where the cost savings come from, specifically the commodity hardware that you can deploy. Then performance. We hit over 1 million IOPS. We hit over 10 gigabytes per second. But not only that, we can also give you large capacities. And you can deploy these large capacities and volumes confidently and with tiering capabilities. And then lastly, there is an ecosystem out there. You can talk to partners. You can check the Windows Server catalog to see what kind of hardware is available and certified today. And of course, support and tools are available in Windows. And again, in Brian's session, you'll learn a lot about how to actually use them, how to troubleshoot problems, et cetera. So at this point, let me flip through a couple slides that are still left here that I have to go through. And then we'll be available here just in front of the stage in case you guys have questions. Here's some of the related content. And again, of course, right after this, I'll be at the storage booth on the exhibition floor as well, so you can meet me there. These are some of the sessions I'd recommend. And of course, please fill out a survey. The surveys actually help us quite a lot to figure out, was the session useful? What wasn't so great? What should we focus on more? What would you like to see? So hopefully next year we can make this better. And then, of course, thank you very much. Come on down, and we can answer some questions.